Hello and welcome to the Q&A Quest episode 406, which is not acceptable for your listening ears. I'm your host, computer nerd Mike Apps, aka Wheels, and with me as always.
Soon to have my very own HTTP error, Dave McBurney, Phantom Master.
And this is Joe Hanley, aka Smokin' Joe Gamer. And I'm playing Final Fantasy 14.
Too many Final Fantasies.
I just fell asleep.
Well, that was quick. Dang, you woke up real quick.
It's okay. This is a better game in front of my eye holes.
All right. Video games. I've had good games to play. That's been nice.
There's a lot of shit coming out last week. And
weirdly.
Yeah.
I think there's two things that predominantly all of us have at least had tangential notice of. And one of them is Edgelord Pac-Man.
Yes. Yes.
Pretty good.
I didn't get that one, but maybe I will.
You should. I will That's be writing good. In the Adventure Corner about it. Because we don't officially cover it. But I think it's...
Pac-Man seems like an untrustworthy little fucker.
Yeah, a little bit.
I do not trust you, Pac-Man. Which is a weird feeling. I've often trusted Pac-Man in my life.
It's a weird game. It's a little rough to begin with. Definitely missing some of the powers I had in the demo I played. which I guess is understandable. But it's very good. It's pretty hard, although not like punishingly so, because there's no real penalty for death other than having to backtrack through areas. But I kind of like that sort of difficulty in this kind of game, honestly.
It'd be fun.
Trying to navigate through different platforming challenges and learning the different enemies and stuff is pretty fun. One thing I really like about it is there were a few bosses I was having trouble with, and it was just like, well, what if I just, fill up my super bar and before going to the boss and then go in there and just go to town on it with that? And it works quite well, and it's quite handy for some of the more difficult bosses I've run into.
One of the things I really like is when you run into a power pellet and goes waka waka waka.
Yeah.
I think that's fun. I like it when Pac-Man goes waka waka waka.
But yeah, I feel like there's already some things in here that have to be weird Namco Arcane game references that I don't know.
Oh, there's tons of them.
Yeah, so I'm going to have to find a primer on what some of these are.
I believe the official website references the game's timeline, which might help elucidate some of the references they're making. Okay. I think there's, most prominently, I think there's some Baraduke references. It's a very old arcade game that is the source of Mr. Driller's mother.
Okay.
B and Dig Dug are divorced.
Okay.
This is true of all canons, for the record. Dig Dug is kind of a weird piece of shit. I know I've talked about this before, but I'm going to do it anyway. Dig Dug's a weird piece of shit. Taizo Hori, that is his proper name.
Okay.
Taizo Hori is just like I said, he is separated from Mr. Driller's mother, and there is an entire game, I believe it is Dig Dug Digging Strike for DS. I believe that is the one that the crux of the plot is that he is jealous that his son is more popular than him.
Wow.
I love it.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the protagonist of Baraduke's canonical name. In Baraduke, she is referenced as being named Kissy. I forget what her actual name is at this exact moment. Uh, Masiotobi. That's it. Masiotobi. But yeah. Yeah, Shadow Labyrinth is like another in the long line of Namco being like, you can do whatever the fuck you want to do to our old arcade games if you can make it sell. But this seems like a successful one. Likely to bear more fruit than Shifty looked back in the day. But yeah, I like what I like. Even if you aren't in it for like the weird Namco bullshit, it's like it's a good looking, good plan, like Metroidvania with some Soulsy elements.
Yeah.
And also sometimes Pac-Man goes waka waka waka. Waka waka waka.
Yeah, when I demoed it, you told me there's like a ton of bosses that are like completely optional.
Mm-hmm. Which is always
gotta,
fun.
Yeah, so there's got to be all kinds of secrets and different powers that you don't even need.
And they, like, for those who did purchase the Switch 2, they did the right thing, the good thing, and they just made it so that, like, even though they didn't sell a Switch 2 edition on cart, the Switch 2 edition is just free. If you have the Switch 1 edition, hey, you get the free upgrade. I downloaded the upgrade. Like, this is something I hadn't actually tested before, but which made me appreciate it because I didn't expect it to do this. But if you've already downloaded a Switch 2 edition update and you insert the Switch 1 edition, like the game card, it will just like key to that Switch 2 edition and just like it won't pollute your home screen with multiple tiles, which was fully what I was expecting it to do.
Yeah, that's what Tony Hawk did. I ended up with two icons and they look identical, and I downloaded the wrong version. And when it was 30 FPS, I almost lost my shit.
Yeah, at that point, you can remove... It is easier to remove things from the home screen than it used to be.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was nice to see it just immediately like, oh, you have the Switch 1 cart in, and you have the Switch 2 edition already downloaded. Clearly, you just want those to be the same thing.
Smart delivery, yeah. Huh?
And we don't
reference that shit anymore.
Not anymore.
Smart delivery to your ass.
That sounds absolutely filthy and nightmarish. And also, they charged $30 for it, which is, like, I think, a pretty fair price. Like, yeah. You know, it seems like there's a fair bit of meat on its bones content wise. It's pretty, it plays well. Like, I think it's nice. I think it's neat.
I think if they had priced that Prince of Persia game around there, maybe not at $30, it probably would have done a lot better.
Yeah, like maybe 40 like might have been a better price for that. I think they pushed it at 60. I think that can be a bit of a hard sell for ultimately you need like hardcore players are going to be the ones that initially evangelize this kind of game. And I think some of them balked at Prince of Persia at 60, which is a shame because it's great. But
it's great. I think it's probably better than this game, but I appreciate a lot of what they did about this game. Like they seem to really want to engage with that community and try and sell it directly to them, which I think is smart.
Yeah, and it's just kind of a freaky weirdo game, and I like those.
Yeah.
So.
No, it's weird as shit, and I love it.
If you're on the fence on that, like, I'd say it's definitely worth the 30.
For sure. And yeah, I really need to look up some of the references, because I wandered into, like, the second area, and it's like a fantasy-ish thing with, like, mm-hmm. little goblin things jumping down from ropes. I'm just like, I thought I was in a sci-fi game. What the fuck is going on?
Yeah, it is also for, like, old-school Namco arcade perverts, so... Which, yeah, it's fun. Bear in mind that I'm a sicko in a really weird way. I spent, like, half of my evening last night sending references to like extremely ill-considered pieces of Bonk's Adventure advertisement media to people just to like confuse them. Like, I found, like, an image of a limited edition t-shirt circa, like, 1990 that was a picture of, like, the American bonk, like, the American bonk promotional art, which tended to be different from the Japanese stuff. But the American bonk promotional art with him, like, bonking a stock image of Saddam Hussein for some reason. And just the words on this shirt were, bonk, bonk, Saddam Hussein. That's how you market to the children during the Gulf War. There's much strange bonk media to be found if one knows where to look. But yeah, and that leads us to the other thing that came out, which, if I really wanted to be a piece of shit, and I think all of us could manage this.
Do it. Do it.
I could argue that it's an RPG.
And? Say the line.
Like,
say the line.
I've said it before about Street Fighter VI, and I can say it about this. It's more of an RPG than Final Fantasy XVI.
Yes! It really fucking is.
There are more build varieties. There is more to be considered about resources.
And it has a better story.
It does.
And your female character actually has a personality.
Nice. I enjoyed that. Pauline's adorable. Yeah. We are, of course, talking about Donkey Kong Bonanza.
One of the best games ever made.
It's so good. Like, they just, like, you know, it's been 8 years. I love Mario Odyssey with all of my heart and soul. I wasn't sure what the, like, this is the closest thing to a follow-up it's gotten. I wasn't sure what that was going to feel like. It's so good. It's so good. And it's just one of those things that, like, terrain deformation, like, you know, people have been doing it to some greater or lesser extent for a number of years as the gimmick. Like, the first time I remember running into it was the original Red Faction, with its Chiyo mod tech, which became kind of the series trademark for as many games as that series had, which is about 4, I believe.
This just
feels so much more tactile. In part because Donkey Kong is just picking things up and hitting them. There's no intermediary. You don't need a big gun. Like, just walk up to something and start punching it, and it will start breaking unless it is made of certain kinds of material. Mostly stuff that's used to determine the outer bounds of a level or something that's meant to be an obstacle. But for the most part, the game just likes letting you smash things. The game will, in fact, reward you every time you run into certain NPCs that are like, hey, good job breaking things. Here's a banana.
Banana.
I think.
Oh, banana.
It is a game that is at once an obvious celebration of everything that Donkey Kong has ever been, while not being lost in nostalgia, which is very important. I'm genuinely just deeply impressed. Okay, yeah, I've currently got collected 265 bananas. I have missed a ton. There is just so much. But the nice thing is that, like, I remember certain people I've met had difficulty gelling with Mario Odyssey, because power moons are just everywhere. And in much the same way, bananas are everywhere in this. Banandium gems, that monkey is going to eat so many. But their function is just fundamentally different, because the structure here is very interesting, because it is, theoretically, it's a much more linear structure, despite the even more open nature of the levels. You just need to figure out a way to get where the game says the next, like, boss is, get there and beat it up. Drill to the next layer. You could, and like speedruns of this will probably be interesting to see. I saw at least one point where the game kind of wants you to do two worlds. I absolutely found a way to skip one of them. I expect there will be better ways to skip that for speedrunners, but you know, it's a game that lends itself to creative solutions, despite the relative linearity of how certain things must be approached. But the other thing is that, like, in order, because of that structure, they came up with a very different purpose for why you would be, why you would be still going after the bananas. And the answer is that they are your experience points.
Yes.
You need to, like, they get you useful new abilities, like double jumps, stronger punches, more health, like stuff that will make getting through the levels more interesting and easier. But, like, you can also get around those. Like, all those abilities are really nice. But if you know what you're doing, you can do really stupid things too. you can like smash certain, like, if you're keeping a good idea of how certain like kinds of environmental objects interact, in mind, you can find very non-traditional paths. We'll go with non-traditional. You can make interesting use of your bonanzas, especially once you start getting some of the ones that have more movement powers. It's just exciting. Every new place has, like, it is impossible to play that game the same way twice, because, like, you're just constantly, even by accident, you will just be breaking shit, because DK is just enormous, and like, just falling onto something will typically, like, if the ground is soft enough and you fall on it, well, guess what? You just broke some of it.
Yep.
Like, you know, and you can, on occasion, I have blown up too much and made things hard for myself. Because suddenly something that was supposed to be, okay, do a quick climb or, you know, just walk up a hill, but I have already crashed through so much of it that the only way up is through a horrible jumping puzzle of my own design.
Yes.
Which is fun. It's fun to do that because you do still have the resources to make it work. And if you really hate what you've done, you can regenerate that terrain if you really need to. But also, for a lot of the time, the game is just going to sort of leave things broken for a very long time, longer than you think. It's just fun. It's incredibly fun. It has so much Odyssey and Breath of the Wild in it, but doesn't feel like, it feels unique from both of those. And I don't know, it's kind of neat to have, like, the oldest Nintendo character of consequence has just come back and had one of the most, like, fresh feeling games I have played in years. That's wild. That is a wild thing to think. Donkey Kong.
I have not played a platformer that felt like it had, like, really new ideas in a long time.
Yeah, like, there have been great ones. Like, you know, you look at something like Astrobot, that's a great game, but it really is just trying to be Galaxy. It is. You know, pilfering from the Galaxy playbook. This is something that does not feel like what else is on the market, or really anything. For the record, the original Donkey Kong is 44 years old.
Damn.
And this, the fact that there is a new Donkey Kong coming out that is identifiably, obviously, sequel that has elements referencing the character's long history since 1981, with things like there's plenty of references to things like, gameplay elements will reference things like Just the notion, one of the things I think about a lot is like the notion of like you clap and it sends out a shockwave that collects whatever happens to be near you. That is ripped straight from Donkey Kong Jungle Beat on the GameCube. You have things like the... you have things like some of the bonus stages that will have like visual or game, well, both visual and gameplay references, and also just straight up musical tracks taken from the Donkey Kong Country games. Like, it is respectful to everything that Donkey Kong has ever been without feeling like it is lost in nostalgia or like reverence for the brand, which is a very tricky thing to do after a certain point. So good job on threading that particular needle. And also the game just has really good vibes. I like sometimes just sitting around, like taking a 10, 15, 30 second break of just sitting there and pressing the button that makes DK fucking whistle and Pauline sing along with him. Because that's just good vibes. That just feels nice.
Yeah, I'm in a region right now where there's like lava raining from the sky and I have to pick up a rock to use as an umbrella.
You sent Donkey Kong to hell.
And then there are these zip lines and you pick up a piece of the ground and you use it on a zip line. And you better hope you make it to the side before it deteriorates.
They make a lot of use of, like, one of the things that, like, I think abets the Breath of the Wild comparisons, aside from the, like, bonuses, like, certain things about, like, how the health system works and how the kinds of bonuses granted by different outfits. One of the things that, like, it strikes me as feeling very Breath of the Wild-esque is the game using just sort of a handful of actions to produce a lot of very strange, a lot of different play states depending upon things like world material. Like, I think a lot about, like, Turf Surf is just the shield surfing from Breath of the Wild with a, you know, like, you rip something out of the ground and depending upon, like, the material of the rock and its individual toughness, you can surf around on it. But that's going, you know, that breaks it down in much the same way that surfing on your shield did in Breath of the Wild. But in such a way that, like, you know, you're a little more improvisational because you're not as concerned with inventory. Like, it's just, well, this is what I have to hand. How well will it work? And you can get some fun stuff there. Like, you get, like, you find lava near ice. You have a lot of ways of cooling of using the ice to cool the lava. Like, any interaction that puts ice to lava will work. So you can throw it, you can swing it, or you can surf on the lava on the ice. It feels good.
It's a goaty contender for sure.
Oh, definitely. Like, it seems like it's that, Expedition 33. I'm sure there are other things, but those seem like the front runners to me. Death Stranding 2, perhaps. Yeah, I'm looking at, like, the more general, like, among us, like, yes, I love Rune Factory, but, in terms of, like, the general contenders you're going to see at the end of the year, it's likely going to be Donkey Kong, Expedition 33, and Death Stranding 2 thus far.
Yeah. Sounds like it.
Expedition 33 is really good and would make a very nice Switch 2 game.
I mean, we know that they are entertaining the possibility, so we might see it sometime in a year or so.
Yeah, so I wanted to say that the two biggest improvements in Bonanza over, like, Mario Odyssey is that, you know, you're not just collecting the bananas to progress through the game, that's your XP. You get the skill points, like you were saying. You know, because Mario Odyssey is a great game, but it's still that same formula as Mario 64, DK 64, Banjo-Kazooie, where, oh, okay, you need 10 more stars or puzzle pieces or whatever to get to the next area. So once you do that, you're like, okay, cool, I'll just go to the next area. Whereas in Bonanza, it's like, well, no, I want to get all of the bananas. I want the skill points. Yeah. I'm already revisiting old areas to get more bananas because it's just fun.
It's when just you get new game. Bonanzas, new things open up in the old areas.
Yeah. So then also, I like that the outfits are not just cosmetic. They actually do stuff, which is, of course, similar to Breath of the Wild, Tears of the Kingdom. So Mario Odyssey had some really cool outfits, and they were fun to unlock, don't get me wrong, but I like when, you know, I get an outfit that says, okay, you 10% resistance to lava damage, for instance. Like, oh, that's helpful. You know?
I used and abused the one that made me faster in mud and snow.
Right, so comparisons to DK64, Mario Odyssey, etc., those make sense, but really, I'm just getting more of a Zelda and Metroid vibe from playing this, really.
It has a lot more elements of that than I think anyone would have guessed from the idea of a 3D Donkey Kong game before now.
For sure.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a similar formula, but it still has its own distinctive identity, and this is the game that Donkey Kong deserves. This is only his second, like, 3D platformer, and it's like, man, it's just so good.
It's so good. And one of those things that, like, makes me feel like I don't know that I've seen a developer, like, call a shot quite as hard as this, as, like, when you look at interviews and the producer on this game and one of the leads of Nintendo EPD, Yoshiaki Koizumi, mentioned his directive was, you know, that he wanted the team to make a game that would be the blueprint for what 3D Donkey Kong games played like. So, I'm excited that we live in a world where this will be the blueprint for future games.
Hell yeah.
Well, and even if they do a Mario game like this, it's like, that'd be cool. You know?
I think that what they'll do is that they'll continue to differentiate so that Mario games will be different. They want those to exist.
Guys, minor spoiler, I just unlocked the Elephant Bonanza.
Oh, bazinga.
Oh.
And the elephant uses his trunk to suck things in, and then he can spit them out too, I think. Maybe?
It's like Donkey Kong Country 3, it's back.
Would we want that one back?
Got a moment. I appreciate that Cranky has in his whatever his current age is, he has realized that he needs to bribe people to listen to him talk, which is why he gives you a banana every time.
But I want to ride Rambi, damn it. No, you can give Rambi a high five and he likes it, and then he might give you some money.
I appreciate that, like, that was how they went about this, was that if you use the punch button near a friendly character, if it's one of the rock denizens, you punch them, they break, and they're like, oh, that was fun. Because the fractones are frankly nightmarish creatures. If you punch something that, if it broke, it would turn into a horrible mess. Instead, it just, like, sort of detects that, like, you're about to hit a friendly NPC and instead turns it into a high five.
Yep. It's great.
Adorable. Unlike the fractone.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think I smashed one of the fractones. He was like, thanks, I wanted to change my form anyway, or something like that. And it's like,
there is at least a few fractones that will have something inside them.
Oh, God.
Like gold or a fossil. And they'll be like, oh, this sucks. I don't like this. And then you punch them and they're like, oh, thank you. It's gone now.
They're so
and
weird.
It's like, I am concerned that detonating your head was something you wanted. But there are times when it's like, well, the Fractone is the most solid thing that I can pick up. I am going to rip part of it off and surf around on its body.
I love your personal butler.
Fractone? Yes. Oh, yeah, your concierge service.
It turns into the different shops.
Yes, and then asks you for a tip.
Yes.
I mean, it's only 10 gold.
I tip him every single time.
Of course.
Oh, man, I got the elephant bonanza, and so he sucks things up with his trunk, and as he sucks things up, he stores extra, like, rocks that you can just pull out and just throw without having to pick up from the ground, you know? It's like, wow.
The imagery around this is nightmarish, and I am looking forward to seeing it, but the other thing I will bring up that I appreciate is that when you, like, you can pay to have, like, spots made for Donkey Kong and Pauline to nap to restore health, and the single best thing about that is every time that you open up a new one, there is like a little, like the first time you sleep there, there's a little conversation where Pauline will just sort of comment on something about the area you're in or something that's happened in the story recently, or like, she will just have this little, like, one-sided conversation with Donkey Kong as she's falling asleep, and it's always adorable.
Yeah, I just got one where apparently she falls out of bed and is like, oh, I hope Donkey Kong didn't notice. That was embarrassing.
There's a good one in the canyon level where you're, like, you've made a like, rest spot inside of a crane, and she's just, like, horrified at, like, well, what if I fall out and fall off and die?
Hello.
Hello.
We started late, but there was only so far we could, so long we could wait. But
no worries.
You haven't missed much. We've just been talking about what we've been playing.
Well, let me get my Switch out, and then I can... So, anyway, so Dave, time to guess. As of 11 p.m. last night, last time I saved, this game had 899 hours, almost exactly, on it.
Okay,
in a moment, I'm going to save it again and see what the new timestamp is after not having played it at all for the last 14 hours. So time to guess, what do you think the timestamp's going to be?
950. We'll go with 950.
950. Okay. Well, let me head back to the save point here.
I'll go 951.
Uh-huh. You're not playing Price and Fright rules.
Oh.
I just found a rare fossil, and it looks like the swordfish from DKC.
Nice. Yeah. Okay, so it is in fact 915 hours.
I overshot. That's actually close to accurate. That's wild.
That's a lot less than I thought it was going to be. I was half expecting it to actually be maxed out.
That would have been very funny. Yes. You will at least find out what happens when it hits 1,000, so that's fun.
I mean, it's probably just going to stop at 9999999, but
we'll see.
So, we'll see. It'd be funny if it just rolled around. It won't.
Yeah. So yeah, DK Bonanza, it's every bit as good as it looks.
I've been watching that on stream, or actually a recorded stream while I'm doing laundry and stuff. And it's like, this looks just really fun, and I don't regret not having a Switch 2 yet, but at the same time, this is a nice sign of what's to come.
Mm-hmm. So. When you do get a Switch 2, it will be something to pick up.
Yes.
Yeah, so just this receives Q&A Quest's highest recommendation of please play it, it's good. But so anything to report on what you've been playing other than the current time, Gaijin?
Oh, I also just to have something to when I don't have a lot of time but just need something kind of thoughtless, I just like finally downloaded Vampire Survivors.
Oh, that's very good for that.
That game rules, yeah.
Yeah. I've already got 60 trophies out of it.
Nice. I do appreciate that people seem to have started calling these bullet heavens.
I love it. I
haven't heard that one.
Yeah, I've seen that floating around, and I think it's for Vampire Survivors type games, because it's you spewing out an ungodly amount of, like, damaging things instead of the other way around.
Which gets really fun.
If you can still...
Have you ever seen an inverse bullet hell?
I don't know what that would be.
Well, I played it, played one at Tokyo Game Show 2014, I believe it was. It was Ridiculous Star Knight, which is available for Android, smartphone, and Famicom.
You talking about this.
And the entire point is to try and catch as many stars as you can as they go by. So instead of trying to avoid all the quote unquote bullets this time, you're trying to trying to grab as many of them as you possibly can.
The logical endpoint of Kaboom.
Yeah. So, I mean, I remember even commenting at the game shows, like, yeah, this is kind of an inverse bullet hell. And they're like, really? Yeah, you know, you're kind of right. Yeah.
There are many ways.
But yeah, that's the sum total of my gaming.
Yeah, with Vampire Survivors, if you can still see the ground and you can still discern what's happening, then you're not playing it right. Like, there should just be so much shit coming out of your character that you just can't tell up from down, and you just stand there and watch things die and keep leveling up. It's great. So besides Bonanza, I've also been playing Tony Hawk 3 and 4, of course.
Oh, great.
Yep, and... been playing Final Fantasy 14 again, just for JRPG July, and of course I beat the Stormblood content, sort of. And for RP Gamer, of course, I've still been doing my Visions of Mana streams and just making significant progress on that game, and that's just a great game too.
It's a tragic shame what was done to its developers, because they did a great job of reviving Mana and it came to nothing.
Yep. So I've been playing that, and then on Saturday I did do my own stream. It was a Sega Saturday for JRPG July, so of course I did Metaphor. Making more progress there. I just did this quest where you go to this area and you gotta keep killing like goblins until like the chieftain shows up. And then once he does, he just absolutely kicked my ass. So. Oh, we lost Kaijin. Okay.
Yeah. I wonder what happened there.
I heard the noise and I wanted to make sure it wasn't me. Okay. We'll get him back.
I'm pinging at him to make sure everything's okay.
But Metaphor, still a good game. It's still Persona in all but name, and that's fine. I kind of have to be in the mood for it, though, just because I put so much time into Persona 4 and 5.
It has its own spice to it. I think that, like, the way the metaphors work, not metaphors, but, like, you have basically the job system from Final Fantasy gives it its own flavor. Again, it's something that's using a lot of those same elements with its own flavor, but it's a great one. But yeah, it's also a huge commitment.
Yeah,
and any game that's that much of a commitment, you need to be in the mood for.
And I find that it's not the best game for streaming, just because there can be a lot of downtime between the dungeon crawling and the combat. So, but no, there's a good story there, and it's a great game and I do like it, but it's just, I'll play for a couple hours and then it's like, okay, let's go back to Donkey Kong. You know,
Donkey Kong is that more just like run in and start breaking things, as opposed to Metaphor. Here's a long series of discussions and stat management.
So he's there's back. That. He's back.
Yeah. I had a crash and it wasn't one of the usual ones on this computer.
Oh no.
It's like some animated GIF just killing my video. I'm what had wasn't proper.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
Packet loss.
But yeah. Yeah.
Oh, so then I did jump back into Street Fighter VI World Tour mode just to find Elena and make her my mentor and learn her style and all that. And I'm just every time a new character comes out, you just jump back into World Tour mode. You've got a new quest line to follow, and it's fun.
And yeah, so we've got a Sagat trailer coming soon.
We do. He's coming in August, which is great.
He's back and, to being a weird skinny dude.
Yeah. And then we're getting C Viper is coming back. That's exciting. And then that other guy, Alex, that I don't like. And then Ingrid.
C Viper and Ingrid. It's an interesting set. I'm excited for year three.
I just don't like Alex, that's all.
What do you ever do to
you? Can't escape.
He powerbombed me, dude, and taunted me in his goofy accent. Powerbomb!
Nothing is more fun than hearing "you can't escape." To very quickly run down a string of questions relating to fighting games, actually. Fireminer says, okay. I don't know what the time span was here, was supposed to be. Asked about publishers expanding into markets with low purchasing power and low profitability. It's a problem with fighting games right now. There are tons of Central and South American fighting game fans, but they don't have the money to buy all DLC characters. People have been coming up with following solutions. Which one do you think is best? 1. Cutting down the price of the base game and DLC after 6 months, a year after the first season pass finishes. I think that's like one thing I'll say, like looking at these, is that a lot of them are not mutually exclusive. I think that one's just a natural part of the market, but I think it's also important to keeping a healthy player base. 2. Having the DLC characters be playable in training mode as a free demo for people to try out. I think that's useful, but I think it's also something that's kind of geared towards hardcore fans. A lot of players just playing in training mode, for casual fans, they're not going to get a lot out of, you know, like speaking as a casual fan. Yeah, it's kind of neat to mess with someone in training mode, but unless I'm actually fighting another person or at least a decent computer, I don't really feel like I'm getting to enjoy what it is that's fun about the character in training. Like, the free in training mode concept is nice. I'm not against it, but I don't think it helps casual players that much. Which ultimately, if you want your fighting game to be long-term profitable, you need to, and you know, if you're looking at these markets that maybe have less buying power, you want to get, like, you're trying to make your money in volume. So you want to favor these strategies that, like, you know, maybe you're not making a ton of money per person, but you're making something. You're making it on just the amount of people you're ultimately selling to. DLC characters are free, but everything else from costumes to announcers are paid DLC. Rivals of Aether and Melty Blood do this. I like that conceptually quite a bit, just because, you know, it's nice to make sure that everyone can at least try all the characters, but I think that's one that is ultimately something that ends up favoring, like, cosmetic DLC that ends up being like you end up getting some favored characters that get a lot of DLC attention. It's sort of like how you look at Street Fighter V and Chun-Li has like 18 outfits.
Yeah.
Six
is getting swimsuit outfits, by the way.
Yeah, and it's getting a bunch of other stuff too. There's like some K-pop stuff.
And you're going to be able to play Lifeguard Luke.
Yep. I think ultimately that ends up being being something that, like, I think that, again, for competitive players, that ends up working out really well. And I think for casual players, that's fine. They can have, like, a character that, like, maybe they'll occasionally splurge and get, like, a fun new outfit for them. But it is also one that ends up causing a disproportionate amount of the development team's time and money to go to characters that get a lot, that sell a lot of costumes. And the other thing I would say is that that may be, it maybe biases the game a little more towards making sure those characters are, like, it may have, like, strange knock-on effects to the balance, like trying to make sure that a character who sells a lot of costumes stays relevant. Like, you know, because if you bought a lot of costumes for a character, you don't want the, you don't want to go online and just keep getting your ass beat. So, you know, consciously or unconsciously, that might, like, bias developers to maybe overtune that kind of, like, that character who sells a lot of costumes. Not that I could, like, name an example of that actually provably happening, but it is just something that immediately comes to mind as, like, maybe having certain strange knock-on effects for the game as a development concern.
Well, I can say that I got my ass kicked by Laura so many times in Street Fighter V. He seemed to be a fan favorite, and she had good costumes, too.
She was an attractive lady. If you buy the premium edition of the game on launch, you get the first season pass and its characters for free. That's nice, but it's very much, again, something that's more for hardcore players than anything. Because, like, they're going to be the ones that buy right from the start to begin with. Like, the people who care about the franchise sight unseen. So it's kind of more just making sure that they have a longer tail with it. That they have something to look forward to. The casual players, like, the truly casual players that end up sustaining something like Street Fighter or Tekken are the people that, like, maybe don't even know precisely when the game first came out. Like, and not everything can be that. Like, you know, you mentioned City of the Wolves and Undernight Inbirth 2. Like, that's not going to be true for everyone. Like, not every game can be that. And so, as a goodwill gesture, it can be really nice to do that. But, like, also, you know, one of those games tanked. Ultimately, this strategy for City of the Wolves simply did not seem to noticeably move the needle for the markets you're talking about. Like, SNK has a huge following in Central and South America, and, like, the problem with that is that the underlying issue is still just the game is expensive for places with low buying power. Like, you know, you're buying City of the Wolves for, like, $70. You know, maybe that's a more unreasonable ask if you're living in, you know, certain parts of Central America. And, you know, you already need, like, a reasonably up-to-date PC or a modern console. Those maybe are, you know, like, the all in, like, I think at least from what analyses I've read, some of the problem that that game has had selling in the places where it theoretically would have had a lot of groundswell is just, it's expensive. And, you know, you can pack 100 characters into it, and it would still be, like, you know, for a lot of the audience, it's like, well, I just can't spend that money on a game. You know, and I'm sure that's, you know, an unfair generalization, but, you know, like, it's not nothing, you know, like...
And my next thought is, this is why they need to bring back fighting game arcades.
Like, arcades are definitely where, like, part of the reason that arcades end up lasting so long in certain places is you can experience a high quality game. Like, the business owner pays a lot up front and makes their money back, and the, you know, potentially low income area, you know, you get the chance to play, like, this impressive high quality new game. But, you know, at at a price where you know you're not going to get to spend a ton of time with it, but you get to spend some, and you know it's within your price range. And I think that,
and
and
you're spending in increments that are comfortable for you to manage.
Yeah, hopefully. Like something unless that you can deal with. And so I think that on some level, like, to make something like City of the Wolves work, which is, you know, the one that, like, I think of a lot for, you know, if you're talking about something that fighting game, a lot of popularity in Latin America, big, you know, but generally, like, trying to figure out how to use that to sell in a decent way, like, it ends up needing to be that it needs to meet people where they are more than anything. Like, it's not the value per dollar proposition. Like, you know, if in a pure dollar sense, like, City of the Wolves has way more to it than, like, Garou: Mark of the Wolves. But you can play Garou: Mark of the Wolves for, like, you know, $5. Like, as a purchase. And it's like, you know, you meet ultimately the story we see over and over again with games, you meet people where they are, because there's only so much they can do to reach you. So, and then the last suggestion, just release multiple versions of the game like Capcom used to do. I mean, Capcom still does that. Like, we just got, like it doesn't have a good name, but Street Fighter 6 Year 1 and 2 Edition just came out. Like, they just re-released it, and it's like, here, you can purchase Street Fighter 6 with all of the DLC we've done so far, like, in terms of characters, for the price that it was at launch. And, like, the launch version, like, is, like, $30 now. And, you know, that's just how you do it. Like, ultimately, no matter what else you do, you kind of have to do that.
Yeah, it's like, Steam is good, but at the same time, it also means that you can't actually, or it's more difficult to price things differently for different regions, because people can get around that. And I remember that's one of the reasons why they started limiting regions for markets on Steam to begin with, was because people were going around and getting the Argentine prices.
Yeah, I know that. Yeah, Argentinian, Brazilian keys, like, people would go to key sellers and buy those, and they would be, you know, much cheaper, because that's, you know, the amount that they can at least semi-reasonably be sold there. And ultimately, like, fighting games have to crack that nut as well. Like, you know, I think ultimately you do just have to accept sell for less there, you know. You know, you close off the market however you can, but, you know, it has to be cheaper there, because that's what people can pay for. Like, and it's worth it to do that, because you want, like, one of the things that attracts people to a fighting game is just that there's a lot of people to play it with. So, you know, it's
similar, like, to the white whale marketing strategies.
Like, it's a less...
In order to get people who pay a lot, you need people to play with.
Yeah, it's a less ugly version of pure whaling. Did Wheels disappear? Mm-hmm. Oh, he left his chair. Okay, I see what's happening. But yeah, like, ultimately,
like a similar principle to whaling, is just not as quite as predatory, I guess.
Yeah, it is the less evil twin of whaling, where, like, you want a stable community, and that means having a lot of players. And the way you get a lot of players is to just make sure that people have ways to play your game. Essentially, for every, you know, as long as you know, you're at some point, like, some executive is looking and seeing, like, well, you know, we're not, like, we should be charging the same amount, because, you know, like, it's the same game. And it's like, well, you want a healthy player base, so you should charge less in the places where people can't afford as much, so that, like, you can continue to sell that high, like, that, you know, high-priced version in that high-income territory, and that person will have plenty of people to play with. Like, you know, especially as your netcode gets better, every character becomes a value-add proposition for the people you're trying to sell to. And, you know, you can as the game starts to tail off, you can start, like, all that cosmetic DLC, all the, you know, and character DLC, you just start lowering the price of that everywhere, and you can have a pretty long tail of, you know, new sales and DLC purchases, like, long after you would have thought people were kind of done with it, because there's just a lot of, like, you know, there's a lot of people that, like, the game has a good reputation throughout its lifespan. It's clear that there's still some people playing it. They pick it up late in life, and, you know, that's a lot of revenue stream for assets that you had made and made as much profit as you maybe necessarily thought you were going to make 5 years ago. So, yeah, it really is important to just, like, each of these markets needs to be treated with the understanding that, like, they're all part of a whole. And each of them needs to be treated with some delicacy in that sense of, like, you know, I understand what, like, the... And, of course, you're also looking at markets that, you know, broadly speaking, are increasing in buying power. And, like, so, you know, maybe you start selling relatively cheaper in certain parts of Central and South America. And, you know, maybe in 10, 20 years, you're selling for quite a bit more. But you also have a lot of built-in brand loyalty.
You've developed your fan base.
Yeah, you have a fan base that will continue to follow you as their disposable income increases. So, I think that, you know, it's very...
But that requires long-term planning, and we have kind of proven that most video game companies...
We have maximized for next quarter.
I mean, about the only game company at this point that you can argue doesn't do that is Nintendo, and that's still kind of debatable at times.
I still think the funniest, the most tragicomic thing that I saw was, like, a joke someone made in response to the interviews surrounding the promotion of Bonanza, where they were talking about, like, yeah, this, like, the pre-production on this started in, like, 2017, right after Super Mario Odyssey came out, and we just sort of had people start experimenting with stuff that we had learned in Odyssey's development to see what it would do. And someone responds, like, this is clearly an irresponsible way to develop games. Clearly they should have laid all of them off.
Okay. And was this person actually being serious?
No, they were joking. They were joking.
Okay.
Okay, because you never know.
You never know. You never know. But in this case, they were very specifically joking. But okay, to hit another few of these, remember when I asked a few months ago about costume DLC being cheap to make, but few people buy them? Character DLC is in a completely different ballpark. Expensive to make, but everyone wants them given the chance. The thing is that there's a homogenization going on with fighting games. Instead of letting you just buy individual characters like SF5, more games are having the season pass model, which essentially is another way to make you both pay more and get tied to the game. You can say that publishers are just doing what the rest of the economy is doing, more rent extraction. The thing is, like, you can still, I think most fighting games, you can still just buy a character if you really want to. It's just, and this is like a consumer habit thing, a lot of people, like, so there's a few things at play here. There is the bundle effect. Like, people expect that if they're accepting that they are purchasing a number of things, that they're not sure if they necessarily want all of them or want all of them to an equal degree, it's expected that you lower the price of the bundle. If you don't do that, you get the way people are reacting to things like Kirby and the Forgotten Lands on Switch 2, where it's like, why is this $80? Well, it's a $60 game with a $20 DLC. Well, I'm buying a bundle. I should get a discount. And it's like, I can understand that, but ultimately, that's not what they did. People buying a bundle kind of expect that should get them a preferential price to buying everything piecemeal. But most of the time, you still can buy these characters piecemeal. You can, in Street Fighter VI, you can just buy a character. You do not need to, purchase the entire season pass. I'm actually not aware of any where you have to purchase characters in bundles. I'm not aware of any major fighting game. Like, certainly in all of them, buying all of the characters individually will cost more than buying the characters in a bundle. But that's, you know, I don't think that that's a particularly unique... I wouldn't even really call it a problem. It's just, it's not terribly unique, certainly.
Yeah. But you just have to do math. You know, you just have to figure, gee, there's 8 DLC characters, $5 each, that's $40. A season pass is 30. So, you know, if there's 6 characters that I want, well, by golly, I might as well just buy the bundle and I'll get 2 extra characters. Wow. So,
yeah, it's built on this idea of you defraying the cost by like determining, well, these characters I know I want. These characters I don't know if I want, but I know I want enough of them that the bundle makes sense. Or I only really want this one character, so I'm just going to buy them.
Right. And now I get a bit frustrated, though, because in Guilty Gear Strive, that's I bought the first character pass, and there ended up being like 2 or 3 of the characters that I'm like, I don't like this person, you know? What's his name? Gold Lewis Dickinson? He sucks. He's terrible. But I got him as part of it. So the thing is, in the future character passes, I only bought the 1 or 2 that I wanted, but what annoys me is just the fact that the season pass price doesn't go down based on that. Like on Steam, if there's a bundle and you already own parts of it, they'll give you an additional discount. And I wish Guilty Gear had done that, because I bought just Dizzy because she was one of my favorite characters from the old games. And it's like, well, wait a minute, but now if I buy all the other characters, then I'm spending more than I would have if I had just gotten the character pass. And now I feel like I'm overspending if I get the character pass to get the rest of them. I don't know. It's just weird.
It's one of those things where, like, I get it, but it's also, like, for a really long time, that was just how bundles were. Like, it is only in the age of digital distribution that the idea of, like, price discriminating an individual bundle based on what the user already owns was even possible.
Yeah, that's true.
It's just, like, the nature of market dynamics has created a different kind of FOMO.
So it's just, I have to do this calculation of, okay, am I going to maybe want some of these other characters at a later date? And what is that going to cost me? And yeah, so it's like, you know, sometimes I just buy the bundle because I figure I'll save money in the long run.
So. Yeah. And ultimately, like, one of the things I've just come to accept is just like, sometimes I'm going to lose out and I'm going to spend an extra $10 or $15, and that's fine. That happens.
Yeah,
I'm still making out better than people buying MMO skins.
I know, it's a psychological thing, because it's like, how much extra did you actually spend, though? Well, like $5. Well, what are you mad about? You know? Yeah. So
sometimes one of the things we end up having to do is both that we just have to accept that there are going to be things we're irrationally upset about.
Yeah.
But there's also times when we just have to, like, sort of take a step back and be like, ultimately, even though I'm upset, it'll pass.
Yeah, that too.
Let's see, to hit another couple. You've mentioned before that Steam users have been trained to only buy games on discount. I recently talked to a Malaysian gamer about Upin and Ipin Universe, which was an open-world adventure game based on an animated show popular like 15 years ago. That game is buggy and worse still, overpriced, but the Malaysian mentioned something interesting to me. The average Malaysian earns about $180 a month, so even if an indie game debuts at $20, Malaysians will still wait for it to go on sale. Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense. That is just sort of, that was kind of what we were getting at before, is that, you know, price discrimination being what it is, that's just kind of how that goes. You know, I certainly, if a video game was going to cost 1/9 of my total income in the month, I would be very choosy about it, regardless of how, relatively speaking, cheap it was. When I say, like, Steam players are trained to only buy things on sale, I'm mostly talking about the kind of person who is a relatively like middle class U.S. player who is the kind of person who maybe tries to finish an indie game within 2 hours so they can refund it, even though they then write a review saying that it's great. That kind of person.
Crazy.
There is absolutely a kind of person who thinks that the very notion of paying full price for a piece of media they enjoy is absurd when they could theoretically get it for cheaper. And it's just like that kind of person. Like there was an interesting thing from like an analyst a week ago that was basically them talking about how like the entire business model of Steam is sort of reliant on players buying things that they won't actually play.
Mm-hmm.
I think I saw because that article.
Yeah, and like, you know, it's fair when he lays it out the way that he does, and he's of course talking about like American, European players who buy tons of Steam games just because they're on sale. Like, you know, he's talking about framing it as like a digital collector. I would probably have gone with digital hoarder, but basically like someone purchasing them just to have them. And, you know, how Steam gets buoyed up a lot by people who will never play your game. They bought it because they saw it and it said it was 75% off or whatever, and now they own it, and there is no universe in which they will ever crack that executable up open. But, you know, you got their money. Like, someone who plays your games, who plays a normal single-player game, and someone who purchases a normal single-player game and doesn't spend it, their money spends just as well. You got exactly what you were going to get regardless. But, yeah. You know, a lot of Steam games, their tail is made up by digital hoarders. And I won't pretend that I don't have a strain of that. I've certainly got it less than some people I know who will just buy almost literally anything if it's like sufficiently if it's marked down to a sufficient degree. But those are the kinds of people I'm talking about when I say Steam players have been trained that buying a game at full price makes you a sucker. It's why, you know, a game, you know, the numbers for games being purchased at launch on Steam have gone up, but they're still, relative to the user base, probably smaller than they would be on basically any other comparably sized platform. But, you know, like, you get a lot of long tail stuff because people hear this game is good and now it's 70% off and I'm never actually going to play it, but I can pretend to myself I will.
Yeah.
And that ends up being a good source of long tail revenue for a lot of developers.
Yeah, well, every time I buy something on Steam, it's with the intention of playing it, but yeah, I have like 500 games in my collection, and there's plenty I haven't even touched. But the bigger issue I have is I buy the season pass because it's on sale, but then it turns out it's stuff that's post-game content, and then I never actually finish the base game and thus never play the DLC. So that's a bigger issue that I have. But I was also going to say that, like, you know, you go on Amazon and it's like, okay, if you spend $35, you get free shipping. So I find something that I want that's $20, and then they tell me, okay, that'll be $7 shipping. And I'm like, but I don't want to pay shipping. So then you find another $15 worth of stuff, and then it's like, well, wait a minute, now you're just spending more. It's like, oh, but I got free shipping. Well, yeah, but you spent $8 more than you would have. You didn't save anything.
Potentially on things you didn't even want.
It's not free shipping.
Yeah. It's like, how did they do that to us? They get you. They know what they're
Amazon
doing.
Prime has broken our brains also.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, it's absolutely like broken our minds on how much it actually costs to move things around due to Amazon's absurd economy scale.
So if you buy a thing from somewhere else and you have to pay for shipping,
that's your tax on not supporting the largest and one of the most evil companies on the world.
Yep.
Let's see, and I want to bring this up just because I don't want to miss this chance to shout it out. As a follow-up to that last question, Fireminer said, and the thing is that there are good Malaysian-made games that are cheap. Gigabash is one. It's a King of the Monsters-esque game with Godzilla and Ultraman crossovers. That sounds neat. I will look into that.
That does sound cool, yeah.
Let's see. In response to some of the things we were talking about, when you overload a fighting game with DLC costumes, can you really argue for just owning the game and every character equals having the complete experience of the game? That's the discussion I've heard from DOA fans. Like it or not, playing dress-up has become an intrinsic part of that series. Yeah, although we kind of saw what happens when they try to push that too far, and it killed the series like as sure as anything has ever killed anything. Like, they pushed DOA 6 to maximize the abusiveness of its costumes, and it reached a point where people just didn't bother. Like, that game did not sell, and the endless stream of people buying horny like swimsuits kind of went away because like it was too much. You pushed too much too fast, and like now you killed the goose that laid the eggs. As far as like complete experience or not, like that's always going to be in the eye of the beholder. Like, people will complain that games that have like 100 hours of content aren't complete. It's always going to be in the eye of the beholder how much you're willing to deal with, like, the notion of missing content. Personally, like, I don't have a huge attachment to like these kinds of aesthetic DLCs. So like when I miss them, it's like, oh, that's a bit of a shame, and then I move on. But that's always going to be a deeply individual concern. In an ideal world, you know, we would want companies to avoid this idea of going all in on, you know, the sheer, like, we're just going to make 100 costumes for each character. But as these things go, like, my personal thought process for what little that's worth would be, if they're not selling them to you through some sort of roulette or slot machine system, and they, you know, are still, like, the cost of individual characters is not the worst thing in the world, I can let the obsessive compulsive desire to make sure that I have a quote-unquote complete thing go, because as far as I'm concerned, there's no such thing as a truly complete game. There are simply games that are done.
Very Kawazu-esque in a philosophy, yes.
Yeah, he's a big influence on that thought process. Much respect for the man. Okay. Let's hit a couple more before my voice gives out. So many times I've heard people wistfully asking for a free-to-play game where they can play to their heart's content, every character can be earned by grinding, and the only thing they miss out on are skins, which many never buy anyway. League of Legends is that kind of game, and then League has fans complain about time-limited $500 skins. Even Grand Blue Fantasy fans, who have to suffer a pretty bad gacha system, don't complain as much as League fans. Yeah, I mean, like, you can't escape... What's that? Yeah, people will complain no matter what you do.
League of Legends is terrible.
League of Legends is terrible, but also, yeah, like, irrespective of that, like, you know, a lot of, you know, the there are clearly people who enjoy MOBA games. I don't understand them, but I won't pretend to not. I won't pretend it's not true. But yeah, like, ultimately, you know, the limited time $500 skins are optimizing for the most compulsive players. I have nothing but pity for them. Honestly, if you're gonna
$500,
yeah, if you're gonna make a fucking $500 skin, you might as well just leave it up there for however long. But I'm sure that some absolutely nightmarish table can tell you how many more times that skin sells,
over the course of 90 days if they're told that it will leave after those 90 days and they don't know when it'll be back. And it's awful.
It's horrible.
Yeah, I don't like that. Not a fan.
It is my opinion that no one should spend even 1 cent on a League of Legends skin.
I'm not a fan. But broadly speaking, what I'll say to this is that ultimately these horrible science experiments end up coming about because there's a lot of different, like, you know, you get the pressure that comes from starting at the notion of free to play. Like, okay, this game is free to play, so the money has to come from something. Like, ultimately, like, the, you know, there's no real ad economy in these. You can't, like, even if you played an ad before and after every League of Legends game, a League of Legends game is like 40 minutes long. Like, there would be no way to make that profitable by a purely ad-supported model. The closest thing you could get to a truly free game of that scale would be theoretically some sort of ad-supported model. Impossible. Completely impossible to make that money, money math out. So ultimately that money comes from something. And what we've seen over and over from the free-to-play concept is that every developer finds a uniquely horrifying way to extract that money. And that ultimately the fundamentals behind it are that for every player that gets to have that free experience, it's reliant on the notion of, you know, maybe there are 10 players like that. One player in those 10 will spend irresponsible amounts of money. And, you know, whether they can afford that or not. Whether they can afford it or not. And, like, we just find different permutations of that. And the more things that you look at and say, well, you shouldn't charge for that because I wanted that, the more you run into that. Like, honestly, the thing I would be most sympathetic to, even though it would make me personally unhappy, is to just, like, take Heroes or whatever and just say, sorry, you're gonna have to pop like $5 for one of these. And I know that's probably an unrealistic price, I don't know, but broadly the point I'm saying is that, like, hey, you know, if you're doing this, being upfront, and because, like, one of the other things that also sucks about this is if you do make something purchasable via in-game currency, you have the eternal complaints about whether you know, how unfair the grinding is. And the answer is the grinding exists to make you pissed off and want to spend money to make it stop so you can do the thing you actually wanted to do. The grind will always be there to make it more painful than just popping your wallet open and spending another $5. If you're lucky, it's $5. Like, you know, we see this, you know, and unfortunately, like, we talk about this as though it's exclusive to free-to-play games, but it's obviously not. Like, there's, I've harped on this since it came out, but there is a, you know, Sony released Gran Turismo, is it 7 for PS4 and PS5? And it's just like, that's a game with a button on every single menu that's just a give Sony $20 button. That's a game where an individual, like, car can cost like $200. And that is for a game that launched at $70 on a system that was over $500. Like, you know, there's more.
You can buy the $450 VR headset to play Gran Turismo 7 in VR mode.
God, they did do that. But broadly speaking, the other thing about that is just that, like, you know, we talk about these as though they're free to play exclusive, and sadly they're not. Like, you know, I can't even begin to imagine what the, you know, Call of Duty ecosystem looks like at this point. I have not looked at it. I'm scared to. And I'm not talking about like Warzone or whatever.
Oh no, it's very simple. You pay $70 a year to get the next entry, and then they still, you know, they'll say, "Oh, here's a $15 pack that just gives you a weapon skin and a charm to put on your gun and a calling card." You know,
yeah, that's right.
Call of Duty is absolutely absurd. Now, the Warzone mode is just Battle Royale, and it's free to play, but I don't like Battle Royale, so or you pay $20 a month for Game Pass Ultimate for the rest of your life to play Call of Duty games. There, that's also an option.
I don't think I will do that. But yeah, like it's just kind of, you know, like I really think it's important to like bear in mind that these are not free to play exclusive problems. But it also it does bother me to some extent when we talk about these things, because like it's reached a point where like there is a significant number of players where like the thought process of like, you know, it's abusive to make me pay up front, it's generous when the casino gives me $5 of free tokens. And like I think that this is a much broader problem than just games as well. I mean, like in the US, the proliferation of sports betting apps that exist to financially destroy human beings is horrifying and probably a symptom of some greater problem that I am not at all qualified to address. But I want to also bring that up just as like I'm not just picking on players or free-to-play game players or developers or whatever. I'm just saying, like, there is a deep rot. is a deep rot.
Well, there was a recent episode of Last Week Tonight that fully explained sports betting and everything that's wrong with it in its current state. You know?
Yeah. So
people wake up in the middle of the night and say, "Oh, let me put $2 on that basketball game that's going to air tomorrow," or whatever. You know, it's just people doing it from the bathroom, and, you know, they're sitting on the toilet doing sports betting, and people betting on a ping pong match in Uruguay that takes place at 4 a.m., you know, American time or whatever. There's some very specific examples of things that people bet on. And it's not just a matter of, okay, in this college basketball team, this team is going to win. It's this team has to win by 5 points, you know.
Bringing back in problems with point shaving.
Right. And this specific player has to trip and fall during the third quarter. It's ridiculous. The specificity of some of these bets, it floors me.
Yeah. I mean, like the spread ends up being like hardcore sports bets are almost always on things like spreads and shit, which is where you get like more esoteric forms of like not fully match fixing, but you're kind of fucking with it because, again, like, yeah, just go look at point shaving and like have some fun. But that's a whole other thing that like I think we all have strong negative opinions on, but which I don't think we can really bring much new to that discussion. But that Last Week Tonight is probably a good choice. To hit another couple of these before my voice fully gives out. Let's see. Speaking of which, I previously asked about Pokemon fans thinking that Game Freak releasing two different versions is somehow a predatory practice, while only the most dedicated fans think about buying both versions instead of just going to Facebook or Reddit to find someone to trade online. But I don't remember people complaining about this in the 2000s. I absolutely do.
Oh, yeah.
I had Pokemon Yellow and Red and thought, okay, I don't need Blue.
my parents were happy enough to get me and my brother different versions of Pokemon, which solved the issue of their only being one save file neatly. But broadly speaking, they were not the happiest at the notion that they were, that the two games were not like 100% complete by themselves. They didn't like the, you know, they dealt with it because it was clear that me and my brother both loved Pokemon, whatever. But, you know, to them it was mostly, this is a little silly. But, you know, there definitely were people in the 90s and 2000s complaining about how Nintendo was selling you one game for the price of two. That you had to buy both versions to really have the game, and it's just like,
that's not true though. You're missing
out.
You're missing out on maybe 10 Pokemon out of
you
hundreds.
Missed out on 10 Pokemon and maybe and you missed out on 10 Pokemon and if they were feeling ambitious, maybe one or two side quests. It really was like one of those things where it's people have this like notion, like there is, I think, and I couldn't pinpoint where this comes from, but I think that there has been an uptick in this idea of needing the most version of something, the culmination. I don't want, like, my experience is cheapened at the notion that there is something that I missed, whether it matters to me or would have affected my play through it or not. And I think that that has grown more pronounced with people having more connection with each other. Like, there's just the greater capacity to discuss experiences with something does introduce a greater capacity to have opinions about what was the correct way to experience it. And ultimately, more often than not, you'll look at people and they'll say, well, the correct version is the one that has the most of it. And like, anyone who's seen a bad cut of a movie can tell you that's not always the case. But, you know, or, you know, like anyone who played through the extra side quests in any given Square RPG re-release in the 2000s, or, you know, like having more stuff did not make those better. In many cases, it significantly, like, experiencing those would leave you with a worse impression. But there is a pervasive thought process that, well, I don't want to miss out. I want the most version. And, you know, that experience that exists across media and culture.
That's like the best joke I can think of there is just they make fun of that on The Big Bang Theory constantly. Like, we have to go see the screening of Indiana Jones, you know, and in The Last Crusade. It's like, well, why? Well, supposedly they added 40 extra seconds of footage that completely changes the ending. It's like, what?
Why would you want the ending of Last Crusade changed?
Yeah.
It's not like we're
talking about the things that got added to Star Wars.
Like, yeah, but that's just it. They make
people don't like.
They make fun of it constantly on that show. Yeah. The characters are just like, well, you know, well, Leonard, don't you already have the DVD of Battlestar Galactica? Yeah, but the new Blu-ray edition has, you know, 2 minutes worth of deleted scenes. So it's funny.
Yeah,
it's funny to me.
Totally. And it's one of those things that I think ultimately you kind of just end up having to reach a point in your life where it's just like, well, the version I had was fine. I enjoyed it.
I want to say I think I've watched 3 different versions of Blade Runner and I couldn't even tell you what the differences were. I didn't even notice. I have the final cut and I don't know how much improved it is over the other cuts. That's all. But then there was another cut after the final cut, wasn't there?
I believe the final cut came additionally with a work print cut in addition to the director's cut and possibly the theatrical cut.
Sure, okay.
There are at least 4 commercially available cuts of that film.
I like the one with the
narration. Okay, so random Japanese expression time.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay, so the random Japanese expression that you might appreciate is dasoku, or snake's legs. And it's an expression that means to elaborate
where nothing
or
is good. Nothing would help.
Yeah, to elaborate or improve upon something to the point where the original intent of the item was lost.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. That's yes. a good one.
And this is actually this is actually a very nice story. It's actually in my short story collection there. But
actually, let's
about
start
these two brothers who these two brothers who one was very very skilled and very smart and just an absolute asshat about it, and his brother was more diligent and slow. And so their father gave him a challenge to draw a picture of a snake. Mm-hmm. And so the younger brother was just very carefully trying to paint his picture of a snake. And the older brother finished it really fast and got bored. And so he started adding on to it until it came to the end of the challenge. And dad had to say, well, yes, your picture is very nice, but that's not a snake anymore. That's a dragon. So your brother wins because he actually drew a snake.
I asked you to draw a snake, and I don't care how good your dragon is.
Yes, pretty much. But yeah, so just elaborating and overdoing something to the point where the original intent is lost and possibly ruined.
Where can I read a retelling of that?
Oh, it's in Tanukia's A Teapot, available on Kindle and Kindle Unlimited, along with about 20 other stories and random Japanese factoids. Or you're reading just for your amusement and edification.
Yeah, you'll amuse, you'll get a bit of a cultural education as well.
Yes. I just thought I would mention it because I was helping kindergartners make steamed cupcakes this morning, and a couple of them were living up to this by over-decorating and then this thing where you could drip in color and use a toothpick to swirl it a bit. It was supposed to be able to make patterns, but some of these kids were doing it to the point where it just turned the cupcake mauve.
Yeah, it's just sludged.
Yep. And I was like, yep, this is Dasoku right here.
Beautiful.
Yep.
Yeah, it's getting late on our end, and also I am feeling the telltale, like, nasal drip dryness means that I need to stop talking. So how about you tell me more books I can purchase?
Okay. Yes, we just mentioned Tanuki as a Teapot by Michael Yarimizu on Kindle and Kindle Unlimited, which is all Japanese folk tales, but mostly featuring animals, or all featuring animals in some degree, not always as the main character, as is the case of Snake's Legs, because it's actually two guys drawing Snake. But we also have Princesses of the Pizza Parlor, I need to get the next side story out on that one. I have the cover ready for side story 5. I need to actually get it up. The fifth paperback in that series is going to be available from, Thursday of next week.
Oh, nice.
Speaking of bundles, it actually cost more than the component parts because all of the ebooks together cost less than printing a book would. So if anyone actually feels like grabbing the paperbacks, yay! Grabbing all the ebooks, much more economical and actually better for me on royalties.
So keep that in mind.
I will be honest, the paperback collections exist mainly so I have something on my shelf.
Yeah, it's worth something.
Yeah.
Something intangible.
So also for something on my shelf, I have Vainglorious Long as the Night, which is a Metroidvania lit RPG. Largely for the hell of it, the actual print version has the cover set sideways, on front and back, so that it actually looks more like a Game Boy Advance period Japanese Castlevania game box.
That's cute.
Because I could. Nobody else has a copy, physical copy of this book. Like, nobody but me. It is for my personal enjoyment. If anyone would like to get a copy, please, please. There's two ebook versions, print replica, and actually works better with Kindle, reflowable version. Just because I really enjoyed some of the random stuff I did with fonts. With fonts, font sizes, some Japanese characters, and a few other things, most of which did not work well with Kindle, as it turns out.
This is the kind of additional care and effort you get with an indie author.
Yep. So if you want to see how it looks, check out the print replica version. If you prefer landscape reading style and or dark mode, go with reflowable because those actually work on that. Yeah, I got some feedback about this from a mutual friend of ours, and so I fixed it up for him. And other than that, I do have something, literally something completely different under a completely different pen name, for Michael Spearwater, is haha, just because there are some things where if you are mostly publishing young adult or new adult fantasy, you probably do not want something under the same, a certain set of subgenres under the same pen name. So it was a fun one to write. It's also not safe for work. But under Michael Spearwater, it's, you know, I'm not even sure. Can I find myself under web searches yet? Is some of the, okay, I can find it. If you just search Michael Spearwater, Spearwater, you can find it. Nice. Which is nice. Yay. Found it under amazon.co.jp.
Well, it is at least Googleable.
Yeah. And it's nice that this is, in fact, an incredibly uncommon surname nowadays.
Despite being a real one.
Despite being a real one, yes, it's actually a less common surname than my other pen name surname. which is kind of weird. But yeah. Yeah, so if you just look under there, it's technically, well, it's a travelogue, it is mid to high fantasy, and I categorized it under romantasy just because it's the closest thing that would fit. So yeah, just give that a check out if you're into fantasy, romance, and just lots of really weird world building. I'll just leave it at that. That was a fun one to write. You can tell that I really just really like random linguistics.
No.
And soundboard. Proud of oh. it. And no. Very proud of it, you know. But yeah. Yeah, just check it out. Check everything out. No! Read and yes, apply some of that Steam store purchasing philosophy to
that books. Steam store mindset.
Buy my book. My apologies that it is. Yes, thank you. My apologies that it remains pretty much all on Amazon because honestly, I don't have the spoons to try and figure out anything else at this point. I might try for something in the future. Might try some other alternatives.
It's a lot to ask of a one person operation.
Yeah. I mean, especially since no matter how much we can rightfully complain about Amazon for various policies, some of the alternatives are worse.
No, that's horrifying.
We all have to navigate the world.
On my end. Yeah. So, if in a perfect world, we would have a bunch of other fun stuff, but it's not a perfect world.
Joe, tell us where we can find you as well.
Yes, okay. You can find me on Twitch and Twitch and YouTube and Blue Sky. If you search for Smokin' Joe Gamer... And that's all one word. So you can find me on those platforms. So recently for JRPG July, I've been doing live streams on the RP Gamer Twitch channel, which you're listening to right now. Wow, how about that? And so that's been Tuesday and Thursday nights, 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Eastern time. So I've been doing that. I did my own stream on my channel on Saturday of Metaphor Refantasio. So just been doing JRPGs this whole month. And yeah, so that's where you can check me out. I sometimes do my own streams on Saturdays. I don't know what the schedule's going to be going into August. I'm probably going to keep streaming for RP Gamer. I don't see why not. And we'll see. Yeah.
There's no reason not to. I'm actually getting viewers and chatters when I'm on their channel. So, hey.
Yay.
Why not? Yeah, and then I haven't put up any new YouTube videos in a while. I did do Metroidvania. There's a bunch of those videos on there, and I did switch to June, so there are some streams that I had exported to YouTube of, you know, Tears of the Kingdom, the Switch 2 version, Mario Kart World, F-Zero GX, Pokemon Scarlet with, you know, with the new patch applied. So you can check those out. And yeah, I don't have a plan for August at this point, but I'll probably keep doing the RP Gamer streams. If you follow me on Blue Sky, you know, it's mostly, you know, shit posting and dad jokes and that sort of thing. Just today, though, I was playing some guitar and I recorded it and threw it up there. And I don't know. They cap you at 3-minute videos on there, so you can only do so much. And then, yeah, and then on YouTube also, like, I did a bunch of album reviews. I'm thinking about doing some more of those. So, you know, definitely tune into that at some point. And then, you know, you can chat with me on the RP Gamer Discord server. It's a great community. As long as you don't drop too many F-bombs, you will get scolded if you swear too much on there. Although
we'll look at you very disapprovingly.
Yeah. Although I was trying really hard not to swear during my RP Gamer streams, and across 5 streams and 10 hours of content of Visions of Mana, I only dropped like 1 or 2 F-bombs. And I was kind of proud of myself, but then Pause was like, well, we just don't want you swearing on the Discord server. If you're streaming at 10 p.m., on Twitch, it's like it's on them to avoid the swearing, you know, and kids shouldn't be up that late anyways. And
I mean, we swear on the channel and the show all the time.
I know we do.
I can remember some very memorable episodes where we discussed a lot.
So I think I have at least there has been at least one podcast where the first word was fuck.
Yeah, and so
there definitely was. I can tell you which one it was, and we're not talking about that one again.
So I'm just going to say that, as far as I'm concerned, the boss told me I could swear. So fuck.
Well, shit.
I'm learning so much today. Yeah. Okay, but yeah. As for us, we stream at midnight Eastern, 9 p.m. Pacific every Monday and Sunday, except we will probably not be doing Sunday this week because Wheels is out. But
yeah, I was going to tell you, since I'm already doing a stream on Thursday night, I probably wouldn't want to do that night, but you guys could still do whatever you want. I don't care.
Yeah, I mean, we can do either Wrestling or Wild Hearts, depending upon.
Yeah, and I wasn't going to play Wild Hearts anyways. Yeah, so.
Yeah.
So that's fine. I might tune in and lurk and chat, but I don't expect that I'd be on there. That's all.
Yeah, we'll be happy to have you. However, you end up showing up.
Yeah, totally.
So we have Monday nights. We do the podcast you're listening to right this moment. It streams on both twitch.tv/rpgamer and twitch.tv/askwheels. On Sundays, typically, although again not this one, we do. Our usual shenanigans multiplayer, or just all playing the same thing and gushing about it, like we just did this most recent episode with DK Bonanza. We were all just having a grand old time. But both of those we do typically every Sunday and Monday, 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern. You can ask us questions if you catch us for our Monday streams. In the RP Gamer chat, like, dear friends, I saw Fire Miner and Last Sim on Earth in the chat today. So wanted to shout them both out. It's great to see you both. You can also ask questions in the RP Gamer Discord, which you can get to by going to the community tab on RP Gamer and clicking the invite link. It's a lovely place. Don't swear too much. But it's a lovely place whether you want to ask us questions or not. But if you do throw questions into the podcast section of the Discord, we try to keep tabs on those. You can also ask us questions in the comments section under this very episode on rpgamer.com. We try to keep tabs on that as well. But otherwise, I think that wraps it up, and I feel like I'm going to die. So see you, Space Cowboys.
See ya.
See ya.
See ya.